Wina, a popular singer in Haiti with Ogu, a tribute to one of the most popular and if not most powerful god in the Haiti voodoo belief system, coming out of, many people have traced it back to its Yoruba roots, and it continues to inform the beliefs of people in Haiti and their commitment to things in everyday life. It is part of life in Haiti. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we are going hemispheric and historical at the same time. Our guest is Dr. Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and frequent analyst of world affairs on Lead Stories, as you know. He's here today to discuss his latest work, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. It's just off the press. Gerald Horn has written more than 30 books and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, racism, and war. And he's here with us today. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, quite a title, but it reminded me immediately of the work of C.L.R. James, my countryman, whose work was The Black Jacobins, Toussaint Louverture, and the San Domingo Revolution, which he published in 1938. And I imagine, in a way, this book was in tribute to his work, and it takes up from where he left off. Tell us why you approached this work, and why did you produce it?
You are correct. It picks up where James's work left off. He fundamentally deals with the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, leading to the proclamation of the first black republic in the world, a rare event, that is to say, a successful revolt of the enslaved, leading to a democratic republic. My book traces this story from 1791 to the failed annexation of the island of Hispaniola, that is to say, the island that Haiti now shares with the Dominican Republic. The failed annexation was 1870-1871 by the United States of America, which intended to take over the island and then deport a good deal of the newly freed enslaved black population of the United States to the island. I chose to pursue this topic because in many ways it is a bookend of my book that was published last year, that is to say, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. In that book, I dealt with counter-revolution. In this book, I'm dealing with revolution. In some ways, there are two sides of the same coin. One bleeds into another. What I mean is that in order to oust Britain from North America, that is to say, what is now the United States of America, what happened is that the rebels, led by George Washington, Thomas Jefferson et al., borrowed heavily from France. That is to say that French troops were decisive at the critical Battle of Yorktown that led to the ultimate defeat of the British. But France had to go into debt in order to subsidize the rebels. And so what that meant is that that helped instigate unrest in Paris, which led to the French Revolution, beginning, of course, in the summer of 1789. You should also know that the rebels, led by George Washington, contrary to popular opinion, were slave traders and slave masters and slave dealers of the front ranks, extraordinarily so. And in the run-up to the revolt in Haiti, August 1791, they were dragging boatloads of Africans across the Atlantic with the maniacal energy of crazed bees, manacling and handcuffing every African in sight they bumped into in West Africa in particular. And so this created a demographic imbalance on the French island, then known as Saint-Domingue. And what happens is that this demographic imbalance favors the African population in some precincts by a ratio of 30 to 1, outnumbering and outstripping the ranks of the colonizers and the planters. And this creates kindling for a revolt that duly arrives in August 1791. What happens is, and this is the major argument of the book, is that the Haitian Revolution in many ways creates a general crisis for the entire slave system that could only be resolved with that slave system's collapse, not only in Hispaniola, but in the Americas, not least on the North American mainland. What I'm trying to do is bring the central players in this drama of abolition into center stage. Heretofore, oftentimes our allies, Wilberforce in London, for example, have been granted center stage, where the Africans have been portrayed as bit players. But this is false, and it does not help to explain how and why it was that abolitionism happened to erupt in Great Britain and London, just as slavery itself was under severe stress and under severe challenge in the Caribbean, because, as you know, Jamaicans were involved in the Haitian Revolution from day one. There was justifiable and understandable fear that the Haitians, after triumphing over the French, would then go across the water to Jamaica and liberate Jamaica. And so this helped to induce sober realism in London and led to a steady retreat from the slave trade in the first instance, which, of course, was abolished in 1807, and then from slavery itself, abolished in 1833, 1834. Contrastingly, the slaveholding republic, that is to say the United States of America, dug in its heels. But this did not save it, because after Britain moved to abolition, it linked up to a degree with Haiti to put pressure on the United States of America. If you look at all of the major slave revolts on the North American mainland, Gabriel's revolt in 1800, circa 1800 in Virginia, then where Vesey's circa 1821 in South Carolina, General Nat Turner, circa 1831 in Virginia, they all have Haitian fingerprints all over them. So I'm trying to tell not only a story about the Haitian Revolution, I'm also trying to tell a story about the abolition of slavery, which I think has not been portrayed sufficiently as a class struggle of the oppressed against the oppressor, of the slaves against the slave masters. And when the Haitians triumphed, they basically struck a blow in favor of all of us who have to sell our labor for a wage, that is to say, working people generally. That is to say that slavery served as a drag on the wages and working conditions of working people all over the world. And when the Haitians triumphed, they opened the door for working class liberation to a significant degree, which is one of the many reasons we owe a debt of gratitude to the heroic Haitians, because we will never be able to repay them for what they did for us.
And another thing on top of that, and it's an extraordinarily comprehensive overview that you've just provided, but also, if I may add, the book, positioning your argument this way, you also destroy this idea that freedom was given to people. the European conquerors saw the error of their ways, and they clung to nobler ideas and attitudes and decided to do the right thing and just gave people their freedom. Let's talk about the word Jacobins. And what was the political background to the use of that word? How did it come about? And therefore, why were black Jacobins different from Jacobins?
Well, obviously, I'm taking off, as your prefatory comment suggested, from the work of C.L.R. James, who, of course, adapts that term Jacobins from the French Revolution, that is to say, those in the vanguard of overthrowing feudalism in France. And, of course, with the overthrow of feudalism in France, in many ways, this also helps to strike a blow against slavery. As early as the 1790s, there is a movement in France to abolish slavery, which, of course, is really threatening to the United States of America, which had just had a revolt against British rule based upon the premise and the predicate that slavery would continue forevermore. What happens, of course, is that with the moves in Paris to erode slavery, this leads to a counter-revolution leading to the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte. And with the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte, there is an effort to squash and strangle in blood the Haitian Revolution. And, of course, what happens is that France repeatedly sends boatloads of soldiers across the Atlantic to try to subdue and re-enslave the Haitians. The Haitians fight them off. The British also send boatloads of soldiers, boatloads of redcoats across the Atlantic to strangle the Haitian Revolution. The Haitians fight them off. That is to say that Britain suffers one of its most significant and profound defeats in its inglorious imperial history at the hands of Haitian revolutionaries. But it's also fair to say that the empire struck back. We all know about the sad and tragic story about how Toussaint Louverture, General Toussaint himself, is kidnapped by the colonizers and bundled off to Europe, where he dies in pain and, of course, in, to a degree, in misery. But I also extend this story to a degree, and to a degree that has contemporary relevance, because as the subtitle of my book suggests, I'm also dealing with the origins of the Dominican Republic. Now, you know that when the Haitian Revolution triumphed in 1804, they fundamentally only controlled the western side of the island, what we now today call Haiti. The eastern side of the island was controlled by the slave dealers and slave traders extraordinaire, speaking of His Catholic Majesty in Spain. What happens is that as a result of the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte and his pretensions for dominating Europe, hammer blows were inflicted upon Spain, which of course leads, as we know, to Spain increasingly being pushed out of the Americas, beginning in Mexico in 1810. And so what happens is that in 1822, the triumphant Haitians march eastward and take over the Spanish side of the island, abolish slavery, which, of course, is very threatening to the North Americans, that is to say, the United States of America. And then, in a further maneuver, the Haitians begin to invite the so-called free Negro population to migrate to the eastern side of the island, which they do. And, in fact, their descendants still reside there, particularly in Samaná and Puerto Plata on the northern side of the island. It's estimated that at least 13,000 from the United States, black people, migrated to the island. And, of course, they brought significant skills and resources with them. Many of them came to play a major role in the Haitian government. But the empire struck back in 1844 when, as I tell the story, Secretary of State John Calhoun of the United States of America, a hawkish defender of slavery, and one of the early and successful covert actions in the history of the United States, long history of covert actions, helps to sponsor a secessionist plot in February 1844 that leads to the independence of the Dominican Republic. Now, let me say quickly that I support Dominican sovereignty. I do not want to cast aspersions on the Dominican Republic today, although obviously you can't understand the fraught relations between Haiti and Dominican Republic as we speak, in terms of the DR expelling many of its nationals who they're defining as Haitian, you can't begin to understand the color phobia in the DR without understanding this history that I detail in this book. And what happens, of course, is that bloodshed erupts for years between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, commencing in 1844, to the point where in about 1860, in a rare, extraordinarily unusual maneuver, the Dominican leaders invite the Spanish to come back to recolonize the DR. That is to say that nations oftentimes, as far as I know, resist colonialism. The DR, in a rare maneuver, welcomed colonialism because it was so fearful of Haitians. But what happens is that that was not true of all Dominicans. Many of them are supported by the Haitians in the 1860s and casting out the Spanish, driving out the Spanish. But unfortunately, the travails of the island of Hispaniola do not end there, because what happens is that this is taking place as the U.S. Civil War is erupting. The so-called Confederate States of America would like to see a new birth of slavery and slave trading. That is to say, they wanted to turbocharge slavery and slave trading. Rather than going all the way to Africa, they thought that it was a nifty idea to go to Hispaniola and kidnap these free black people, Haitians and even Dominicans, and drag them to cotton fields in Mississippi and Texas to labor for free. And there were a number of instances like that that I detail, but you would think that with the end of the U.S. Civil War and the abolition of slavery, that the travails of this island would end along with the conclusion of the war, but you would be wrong, because what happens is that after the U.S. Civil War concludes, the U.S. rulers come to this conclusion: if slavery was the cause of the Civil War and black people were the slaves, perhaps we can remove a problem by removing black people. So just as there were efforts to deport black people en masse to Brazil under Abraham Lincoln, and there were efforts to deport us en masse to Ecuador, there was also an effort to deport us en masse to the island of Hispaniola. But first, they were going to annex the island, liquidate Haitian sovereignty, and then, of course, the stalking horse, so to speak, was to first take over the DR and then covertly try to take over Haiti. This barely was defeated in the U.S. Senate. And that's basically where my book concludes, that is to say, the failure of the annexation plot 1870-1871. But as you know, the problems between the island and the United States do not end in 1871. You know that approximately 100 years ago, there was a U.S. occupation of Haiti and the DR, that only concludes in Haiti, at least, in 1934. We also know that under the dictatorship of Rafael Trujillo in the DR, beginning in the 1930s, you had a premonition, if you like, of what's unfolding in November 2015, that is to say, the persecution of dark-skinned people in the DR, because Trujillo in the 1930s massacred, not only deported, but massacred the numerous dark-skinned nationals. And, of course, we also know that in 2010, you had the tragic earthquake in Haiti that led to tremendous loss of life, that led many of us to contribute money to the U.S. Red Cross to build housing in Haiti. We're now wondering where that money went. It certainly didn't go to building homes. It's a major scandal. Another major scandal are the kinds of misdeeds perpetrated on the island by the Bill Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, with Bill Clinton as a kind of viceroy of the island. And this was particularly the case when his spouse, Hillary Rodham Clinton, was Secretary of State. The travails of Haiti never cease to end, seemingly. And, of course, we also know that what helped to weaken Haiti was the fact that it was forced to pay reparations to France, that is to say, not reparations to the enslaved, but reparations to the slave owners. This weakened Haiti tremendously, and in fact, it enriched the United States, because many of these slaveholders from Hispaniola migrated to New Orleans, which before 1860 had the largest number of millionaires per capita in the United States of America, not least due to the blood, sweat, and tears of Haitians who were earning revenue and then sending it fundamentally to these New Orleans millionaires who were oftentimes the slave owners. So once again, we owe an enormous debt of gratitude to Haiti, particularly in this moment of stress as we speak with elections that's taking place in October 2015. These were Florida-type elections, apparently a number of ballot box stuffings and all the rest, and it's unclear who will prevail, although what is clear is that the Haitians will never give up their ceaseless struggle for democracy and independence.
What the book does, in a way, is bring to our attention how valuable this region was, this hemisphere was, to all of these interests. Europe, United States, Spain, France, all had an extraordinary vested interest in the subjugation, in slavery, and the continued subjugation of the peoples of the region. What was it about the region that was, that made this so important, strategically important to Europe, to the United States, to empire building?
Well, as you well know, as I stated in my book on 1776, slave trading was one of the most profitable enterprises known to human beings. That is to say, the profit could be at times upwards of 1,700%. That is to say, you invest $1 and get $1,700 back. There are those who would sell their firstborn today for a 1,700% profit, not to mention selling some African who they did not happen to know. We also know that this enormous profit helped to turbocharge the system known as capitalism. That is to say, this is a point made by Caribbean historians such as your countryman Eric Williams, not to mention Walter Rodney of Guyana, and other historians before and since. And then with the triumph of the United States and its pretensions to being a superpower, which emerged as early as the 19th century, the Caribbean becomes important for those who would like to challenge the United States, Britain not least. And this is one of the reasons, it seems to me at least, why Britain is impelled to move towards abolition, because it allows it to claim the moral high ground in its confrontation with the United States of America. It allows Britain, in fact, to have on its side, to a significant degree, a good deal of the U.S. black population, which, after all, found sanctuary in British-controlled Canada at a time when slavery was running roughshod over the U.S. jurisdiction. And likewise, during the period of slavery, you also saw a number of the U.S. black population escaping to Bermuda, escaping to the Bahamas, escaping to Jamaica. In fact, you may recall that in my book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, I talked about the War of 1812 and how many of the black population in the area around Washington, D.C., and in Virginia, Maryland, generally, helped the Redcoats to torch that nation's capital, speaking of Washington, D.C., claiming reparations because they then looted the White House, and then were transported by Britain to Trinidad, which they had just taken over earlier in that 19th century, where their descendants continued to reside. So the Caribbean was important, not least because it was a staging ground whereby Britain could challenge the United States, and the same holds true for the other major powers, such as France, such as Spain. And in fact, you know that in my book on Cuba, I talked about the contestation over Cuba and how Spain was being constantly threatened by the United States with being ousted from Cuba. Spain held on tenaciously to the Pearl of the Antilles, speaking of Cuba, until being pushed out in 1898, a blow from which Spain arguably has yet to recover. So the Caribbean is important. And Hispaniola is particularly important because of its vast natural resources. It's mahogany, it's gold, it's timber, other kinds of natural resources that, quite frankly, have yet to be explored sufficiently, particularly by the government on the eastern side of the island, speaking of the Dominican Republic. So I could go on in this vein, but I think you get the drift of where I'm heading.
We're talking with Professor Gerald Horn about his latest book, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. Just one quick reference here to the importance of the struggles of Haitians, the successful rebellions in Haiti, and how these strategies, the military tactics taken, were also templates for similar struggles in Central America, South America, in the United States, places like Louisiana, Texas, and so forth. How did we know that Simon Bolivar, for example, basically took instruction from the military strategists from Haiti? How important do you think this has been in the annals of history, talking about the connection of Haiti to these successful rebellions against empires?
Well, to repeat, the triumph of the Haitian Revolution led to a general crisis for the entire slave system that was resolved only with that system's collapse. That is to say that, like successful revolutionaries anywhere and everywhere, the Haitians felt the need to spread their gospel. And so shortly after the triumph of the Haitian Revolution, you begin to see simultaneous uprisings of the enslaved, not least in Barbados in 1816, with the word Toussaint and Saint-Domingue and Haiti on their lips. In fact, if you look at the transcripts, as I did, of the interrogation of the enslaved who sought to overthrow slavery in Barbados in 1816, they all seem to be speaking from the same script. That is, they're all making references to Haiti, and they're all making references to how that success was inspiring them. The same holds true for Jamaica, which probably has the most tumultuous history of all the Caribbean islands. But the first point is that the kind of guerrilla war that the Haitians pioneered in and specialized in during the revolutionary era from 1791 to 1804 was then mirrored in other islands. It just so happened that in the 1790s, you had similar guerrilla conflicts erupting in Grenada, for example, under General Fédon, which almost ousted the colonizers in a replay of the Haitian Revolution. In St. Vincent, another Caribbean island, you had another kind of guerrilla conflict. What distinguishes the St. Vincent struggle is, number one, the fact that a number of the indigenous population had merged with the African population to form one fighting body. This was not unlike what had characterized Florida, the now Sunshine State of the United States of America, which, as you know, after the U.S. takeover from Spain circa 1819, there were repeated wars, three Seminole Wars, as they were called, with a merger between the indigenous and the Africans, and those wars not including to the 1850s with the defeated party, speaking of the indigenous and the Africans, then deported to Mexico, where their descendants continue to reside. Likewise, with regard to the struggle in St. Vincent, those brothers and sisters, at least a good deal of them, were also deported, this time to Central America, where they helped to form what is now referred to as the Garifuna population, which, of course, is a very vibrant population, with many of the Garifuna now living in Brooklyn, many of them living in Los Angeles, etc. But you should also know that after establishing a government and a regime, the Haitians also developed a navy that sought to interdict the slave ships, which was something that was quite threatening to the United States of America in particular, which was the leading slave trading power, as you know, ousting the Spanish from the leadership of the slave trade to Cuba as early as the 1790s and becoming the major force in terms of the slave trade to Brazil as early as the 1830s and the 1840s. I talk in the book about confrontations between the Haitian Navy and not only slave traders, but also between the Haitian Navy and the U.S. Navy, particularly when the U.S. Navy sought to come to the assistance of the Dominicans after the secessionist plot triumphed in 1844. So the Haitians, I think it's fair to say, shed blood and treasure on behalf of the rest of us. That is to say, they shed blood and treasure in order that slavery would be extirpated in the Americas. Now, of course, this was enlightened self-interest, because it's fair to say that as long as slave regimes existed in the Americas, Haiti itself would be threatened. And, of course, that proves to be accurate, but that does not detract or distract from the enormous sacrifices of the Haitians.
Well, one of the reactions clearly was the co-optation of African-American leadership to kind of dull the impact of the success of the Haitian Revolution. How did that happen? I mean, how did the Lincoln, for example, and other presidents react to this power that they did not expect or suspect would be so pervasive coming out of, quote, slaves, unquote, establishing the first black republic in the hemisphere? What did they do? What was the tactic that they did, the tactic that they adopted here in the United States to chill out through proxy leadership the aspirations of blacks here?
Well, there are two sides to the coin. First of all, you need to know that the Haitian Revolution was found to be tremendously inspirational to the black population throughout the hemisphere, in the United States not least. And this is evidenced by the fact, as already noted, that thousands of so-called free Negroes migrated to Haiti to contribute to the building of this independent black republic. With regard to Abraham Lincoln, of course, he followed the path of previous U.S. presidents, most of whom were slave owners, in the first instance, by failing to recognize the Haitian government. This was the case from 1804 to 1862. By way of contrast, the Cuban Revolution was unrecognized by the United States from 1959 to 2014. 56 years versus 58 years. And in the case of Haiti, I guess you could call that progress. But one of the reasons why the Lincoln regime chose to recognize Haiti when it did was because, of course, it was under fire from the secessionists, the traitorous secessionists of the so-called Confederate States of America, sought to overthrow the United States government and so they could expand slavery not only throughout North America, but presumably throughout the hemisphere and strengthen it throughout the hemisphere. I mean, that was their ultimate harebrained scheme. And it was at that point that Washington recognized who its true friends were, because Haiti was one of the few unalloyed abolitionist allies of the United States during the U.S. Civil War. And of course, that was nothing new. You might recall that after the unsuccessful raid by John Brown, who sought to lead an armed revolt against slavery beginning in Virginia, what is now West Virginia, what is now Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, circa 1859, and of course he was captured and he and his Confederates were executed. There were days of mourning in Haiti. It was suspected that the Haitians were in on this plot as well. In any case, this, of course, as noted, leads to the attempt to annex the island. And some of your listeners might be surprised to know that Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist leader, who it's fair to say was a devotee of the Haitian Revolution and made very stirring words of encouragement with regard to the revolutionaries, in a stain and demerit on his otherwise meritorious record, was in solidarity with this plot to take over the island of Hispaniola. One of the concluding points that I make in this book is that black people in the United States need to recognize that getting the form of citizenship that we have in this so-called republic, this former slaveholder's republic, now known as the United States of America, has come with a heavy price. It's come with the price of oftentimes being complicit in schemes designed to undermine our allies. That was the case with the attempted annexation of Haiti. That's been the case with the decades-long isolation of Cuba, even though Cuba played the pivotal role in the liberation of southern Africa with this defeat of the apartheid forces at Cuitocona Valley in southern Angola in 1988, and the implied threat to march on to Pretoria and forcibly oust the apartheid rulers. I think we need to recognize that this bargain that was struck to gain a form of citizenship has come with a heavy price. The price of the ticket has been very steep. And I also say this in light of the recent spate of police killings, Sandra Bland, Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, Michael Brown, et cetera, and the rather lethargic response of the U.S. authorities, not to mention a good deal of U.S. public opinion. History tells us is that if we are to improve our plight, we have to make an appeal to the international community. But making an appeal to the international community comes into conflict with the fact that the people we need to appeal to are oftentimes seen as the sworn enemies of the United States government who we pay taxes to. This is a circle that we have yet to square. This is a contradiction that we have yet to confront frontally. But until we do, I dare say we will always be in jeopardy.
You've written more than 30 books. I just wanted to ask, as a historian, as a researcher, as an academician, what continues to startle you about the discoveries that you make, the historical discoveries, and particularly with this book? Is anything in your mind standing out as something particularly noteworthy that you just were stunned to learn as you researched?
Well, of course. I mean, some of the things in terms of the Haitian Navy, for example, and the confrontations with the slave ships and the U.S. Navy, for example, that was news to me. But also, I have to say that in the contemporary sense, that given the history that myself and some others are writing, I'm always stunned by what I see as the deficits of the U.S. progressive movement, which, to be fair, is under siege itself. And when you're under siege, it's difficult to think clearly. But having said that, I think that its misestimation of the correlation of forces in the United States, its underestimation of the strength of mass conservatism, which I think is encapsulated by something I talk about in my 1776 book, and something I'll be addressing further in the book I'm working on now on 17th century slavery. That is to say, there's a pivotal episode in 1676 in Virginia, Bacon's Rebellion, where a large number, principally of European migrants, not very affluent, rise up against the settler regime headed by Londoners, because they feel that the regime is not moving speedily enough to liquidate Native Americans and take their land. Now, progressive historians, so-called, have interpreted that reactionary move as being a step forward because poor people were rising up against elites. I think it's that kind of misestimation that continues to characterize rather harebrained and blinkered and cockeyed analyses of the United States today, with the progressive movement seemingly not able to ascertain that the right wing in the United States not only has a base in the elite with the Koch brothers, they have a mass working class and middle class base. Look at the elections in the governor's race in Kentucky yesterday, where a Tea Party Republican is elected, not least because of votes from eastern Kentucky, where a significant percent of the population are poor whites, and whose health care, which was pushed through by the previous Democratic governor under Obamacare, is not going to be jeopardized. I mean, this kind of voting against your own interests, that kind of point is seemingly difficult for many progressive forces to grasp, but I dare say that unless we grasp the nettle, we'll have a lot of time to discuss these points as we sit in internment camps in Yankee Stadium.
I know you will soon have to go. I want to ask about the relationship. The point that you've made time and again is how very often domestic issues are undergirded by the concern in foreign lands, of course. You had in the United States this question of slavery, and we have seen the connections where advocacy in Congress, outside of Congress, by activists and so forth, in the time of Reconstruction and even before it, that we had this kind of consciousness. We had it with Garvey, the idea of an international community, a diaspora, with shared interests, a shared history, a shared pain and suffering. Do you see any sense of that today in as pronounced a fashion as it was in those days, that there is a consciousness by people in Congress, for example? I mean, the elections that occurred in Haiti on the 25th, the results which should be known, should have been known since yesterday. We had members of the Congressional Black Caucus go down to, quote, observe the elections, but it was just, you know, it was just, they showed up. And they took photographs and so forth, but there was no real hands-on inquiry into whether the elections were fair and free and so forth. Do you get a sense that there is a marginalization, a deliberate marginalization in these corners where influence, if leveraged, could produce some really good results? That people just dismiss Haiti as being, why bother? It's incidental. No big deal.
Well, I guess the answer is yes and no. I mean, certainly with regard to Congressional Black Caucus, since the untimely retirement of Congressman Ronald V. Dellums, the CBC hasn't really had a forceful and articulate spokesman on foreign affairs. And certainly since the dislodging of Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney from Georgia. With regard to the NAACP, we all know that the NAACP made a bargain with the U.S. ruling elite during the Cold War period that in return for civil rights concessions, they would basically distance themselves from internationalist forces like Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois. And so that's on the one hand. On the other hand, when I look at the Caribbean and I look at CARICOM and I look at the fact that Jamaicans confronted Prime Minister David Cameron on his recent trip to Kingston over the question of reparations, when I look at the fact that Hilary Beckles of Barbados, who is a leading scholar of slavery, has taken a global role in terms of the question of reparations for enslavement, and I think that all that's missing is for some of our more powerful entities, like the CBC and the NAACP, to make these connections. Now, of course, there are many of us who are not as powerful who are trying to make these connections, but our megaphones are not that sizable, whereas those with the sizable megaphones, like the NAACP and the CBC, presumably are not predisposed to make these kinds of connections. But I remain ever hopeful. And let me also say that the United Nations General Assembly met in September with all the world's leaders in New York City. I expected to see some sort of appeal to these world leaders from the Black Lives Matter movement. As far as I know, that didn't happen. But the General Assembly will be meeting again in September, and let a word to the wise be sufficient. There's plenty of time to mobilize for September 2016.
Gerald Horn, author of Confronting Black Jacobins, The United States, The Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. I thank you so much. It's always an education when you appear here on Lead Stories and elsewhere, and I'm so delighted that you could be with us to talk about your book today.
Thank you for inviting me.
All righty. Well, you would notice that a number of issues that Gerald Horn raised were not news to you, because this is what we do here on Lead Stories. Just on Monday, we talked about Haiti and the election as something that we've been watching for a long time. We talked about the relationship between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. We had several programs linking these to things and providing the historical record. We talked about the role of the Clintons in Haiti. We explained that to you. So Haiti should not be something strange to you. And these programs are done to prepare you to get a comprehensive view of a subject matter that deliberately is being ignored. It's just incidental. People say, well, why are we talking about Haiti? Haiti is a little country, someplace the poor. You hear about the poorest country in the hemisphere. But when you hear about the richness of its contribution, and as Gerald Horn just said, the steep price paid for the liberation of people, all oppressed people, all over the world. We have historians who will continue to deny Haiti and Haitians that would deny them that proper recognition. And it's not that, of course, that they gave their lives for recognition. They gave their lives in service of what any people, and so many people around the world in similar circumstances did. They just will not just accept humiliation and subjugation and oppression. And they worked against it together. They, as he said, exported their strategies and tactics so that other people could benefit. We heard earlier, of course, in this week, we heard from Professor Jan Carew talking about not how people are divided when the issue is oppression, but how they come together. We heard about the Africans and the First Nations people getting together and waging a war. The historians of the United States would call it the Seminole War, but it actually was a decades-long war, more than 50 years of war, meaning they fought against oppression and came together against oppression. And this is a natural reaction. We hear also from Gerald Horn, and this is a part of the conversation that is missing, how vitally important, how absolutely important these tiny little specks of dust in the Caribbean Sea, St. Vincent, Barbados, Jamaica, Trinidad, how these countries, these little islands, kept empires alive. And how these empires, Britain or France or Spain, and in other places it was Belgium and Holland and Portugal and Italy and Germany, how these countries deliberately sought out other countries and other peoples and marked them for annihilation in service of taking whatever assets they could get. Now, today it might be an inconvenient thing to talk about slavery, to talk about reparations, to talk about the connection between the objective conditions today of many peoples and why it is that we have seen the constant condition, the condition remaining very constant by design, which is a continuation of the original intent, that there are people who, even before they're born, are determined to be less than people. So when we have these conversations, this is what we ought to be keeping in mind. It didn't just happen yesterday. Nothing that we are discussing really is a thing that just happened. We are coming into these discussions after centuries of careful planning, scientific application of racism and race oppression in order to yield exactly the same result. I just thought I would point out to you how we, on Lead Stories, we approach these things from a systemic point of view, so that when we have a conversation, you also have a context. I hope this program was of use to you and enlightening. It certainly was. It always is when we talk with Gerald Horn. Keep it right here. Coming up next, the NBC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. It's always, as I say every day, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye. From Lagay.